This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, to combat California's housing crisis, one Central Coast resident would like to see more affordable homes built in existing city neighborhoods.
We like to see homes for all income levels in ways that help infill the city rather than more suburban sprawl, which is more expensive, harmful to the environment, does cause more traffic in general.
And later, there's a new fitness trend sweeping or swinging through the Central Coast. It's called aerial arts.
So as long as you can hang by your hands from a pull-up bar for 10 or 15 seconds, you would easily be able to do the trapeze. A 75-year-old lady flew the other day, and she did great and had an awesome time.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, February 3rd, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. San Luis Obispo County is an expensive place to live. Forbes magazine has ranked it as the sixth least affordable place in the United States. County leaders are currently working on a housing plan to help build more affordable housing stock, but that may take years to accomplish, and not everyone agrees on where to put it. Cities across the country are grappling with this same problem. It spawned a grassroots movement called YIMBY. It means yes in my backyard. It's the opposite of NIMBY, meaning not in my backyard. NIMBY is a term sometimes used to describe people who are opposed to developments being built in their neighborhoods. YIMBYs are for them. To help better understand the YIMBY movement, KCBX's Greta Mart recently sat down with the founder of the SLO County chapter, Krista Jeffries. She says the roots of the county's affordability problem are complex, and she provides a historical context to the problem and proposes action that she says can make the county more affordable for everyone.
The YIMBY Club, well, the YIMBY movement broadly is a response to what people are more familiar with, which is the term NIMBY for not in my backyard. And YIMBY stands for yes in my backyard. We say yes to more people, more homes, more places for people to do business and get around town, and in general, more greener, cleaner, walkable, livable cities that are more affordable and accessible to everyone.
Wow. Okay. So what do you do to go about and achieve that goal?
Well, the shortest way to help achieve that goal is to show up at planning commission meetings, city councils, situations where buildings are getting approved and changes in our community that allow more people to get around and more people to live in our neighborhoods, particularly in our exclusive neighborhoods. We show up to support those and we say, yes, we do want affordable housing. We want bike lanes. We want parks. We want cities where more people are welcome and have room to live here.
Okay, got it. And so how did you, just personally, tell me a little bit of your backstory. How did you, when did you move here, or are you from here, and how did you get involved with this?
I'm from the East Coast. I grew up in a city called Virginia Beach, Virginia. It's a military city of about 500,000 people. So the Central Coast was a bit of a change for me on a lot of levels, but I moved to Grover Beach when my husband and I were in Paso Robles at the time. We had another child and we needed more space to live in, and we couldn't find anything affordable in the North County area. And so we happily got transplanted to Grover Beach, and over time we started to see how the affordability issue was not just affecting us, but it was affecting our friends, affecting our family. My husband has had multiple family members who lived in the Morro Bay area who have since moved out of state and couldn't afford to stay there. We have friends who have been homeless. We have a lot of families who aren't homeless but are almost homeless. And we see that that's a systemic issue. And the more I got involved with other people who were struggling, including, you know, ourselves sometimes, the more I saw that there were reasons to get involved, reasons to speak up, and that is part of what YIMBY is helping to do.
Okay, got it. All right. So you're in favor of, or I correct me if I'm wrong, but there are several new developments underway in San Luis Obispo, the San Luis Ranch, the Avila Ranch. John Madonna Company is building the Froom Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've been here for about 3 years, and I've heard people grumble, oh, that's going to be so much more traffic. But I'd say I take it you're in favor of this. And what do you think of all these new developments going up?
Well, new development as a concept isn't bad at the outset. What YIMBY tends to focus on is more infill homes, homes that are closer to jobs, homes that are more walkable to where places that people need to be, you know, closer to more amenities. Avila Ranch, Rigetti Ranch, all of those, most of those are single family homes, and that's not something that YIMBY gets like super excited about, but we do support more homes in San Luis Obispo as a concept, and we certainly hope to see more support in the future for smaller homes, things that are more affordable to more people. But there is kind of a misconception that building more homes will bring more traffic, but it's actually the opposite. And preventing homes actually causes more traffic rather than building homes where people are wanting to live.
Let's get into that a little bit. What do you mean? So that doesn't, it seems counterintuitive.
It does. And it's an understandable reflex. But San Luis Obispo is home to more than half of the county's jobs, but it's home to less than 20% of our housing in the entire county. And so when you have a whole lot of people who can't afford to live in the places where they work, they're of course going to drive there. I think something like 75% of commuters in San Luis Obispo County drive alone to work, and that's what's causing the traffic, not the homes that are being built in San Luis Obispo. It's the people who can't afford to live in SLO, where they are mostly working, that's causing the traffic.
Okay, that makes sense to me, yeah. But ideally, what kind of development does YIMBY want to see the most?
So we're kind of unique in the housing sphere because we kind of straddle both sides of the affordability issues. We like to see homes for all income levels, but particularly in ways that help infill the city rather than more suburban sprawl, which is more expensive, harmful to the environment, does cause more traffic in general, at least compared to infill. But we support public housing. We support subsidized affordable housing. We support condos, live-work units. We support homes that allow more people to live where they want to live. And one of our key issues that we're fighting for is to allow more multifamily homes in suburban exclusive neighborhoods that are currently, it's basically illegal to build apartments in those areas. And we feel that that is part of what's contributing to the unaffordability of our area. Something along the lines of 50% of the residential land in San Luis Obispo, it's illegal to build apartments on that land. In Grover Beach, where I live, it's something closer to 65, maybe 70%. I think in Templeton, you can only build apartments on 6% of their residential land. And that's something that we're seeing echo across California, but really across the whole country. And that's why the YIMBY movement is spreading across the country as well, because the same inputs of having a lot of job growth without building enough homes causes the same kinds of displacement. We're concerned about renters being displaced from homes that they've been in for a long time. It causes displacement, it causes traffic, it causes dirty air, it causes unaffordable cities where nobody's happy and everybody's driving a really long way to work. It's really kind of an all of the above set of circumstances that we support, but that does not mean build anything anywhere for any reason. We do want to be careful about making sure that we protect tenants, that we are protecting our environment, that we're allowing everybody to see the hills. And, you know, it's hard to say what housing we don't support on the outset because we have a 40-year backlog in California of demand that hasn't been met. And so trying to pick apart the exact solution, there isn't going to be a silver bullet to the housing shortage. And so we really want to allow the policies that we have to open up to creative solutions, things that we used to have all the time, especially in California, like bungalow courts. Those are basically illegal to build right now because of parking minimums and setbacks, minimum lot sizes, that, you know, policy decisions around land use that have made things unaffordable or illegal just from a policy standpoint. Maybe there's not a law against it, but it's basically too expensive to build or it's impossible to get it approved. But single resident occupancy hotels are really hard to come by. They used to be a really prevalent way for low-income people to afford a place to live where they could walk to the grocery store, walk to the doctor, and we basically don't build those anymore. But we also need condos for people who make more money. Grover Beach has the fastest growing demographic right now in our city is people making $100,000 or more a year. And when people making that kind of money come into Grover, and they're not working in Grover by and large, when people making that kind of money coming into a city and they can afford these lower rents, they're going to displace people and the rents are going to go up because there isn't somewhere else for them to go. So we do need to be building housing at all income levels. We just need to be careful about how we build it so that we can serve our open space and we make it so that more diverse communities can be woven together.
Do you have an example of something that you and your group have been working on just in the last month or give me some concrete examples of what you guys...
Our latest success story was that we were able to lobby the city of Morro Bay, San Luis Obispo, and Grover Beach to enact an urgency renter protection ordinance. We just got a state bill passed, and we have a state group called California YIMBY. And they work with our legislators in Sacramento to help advocate for legal changes and policies and things like that. But on the grassroots level, we have our local SLO County YIMBY group. And there's about 12 other groups across the state that are all doing their own grassroots movements, and they have their success stories. And one of ours is our Morro Bay, Grover Beach, and San Luis Obispo Renter Protection Ordinance. So in October, they passed Assembly Bill 1482, which was a cap on rent increases. And there was a loophole in that law that allowed landlords to kind of jack up the rent or evict tenants for no reason. And that was fought for at the state level. People wanted stronger protections for renters and retroactivity clauses, but it ultimately got moved out in the interest of passing as much protections as we could get at the time. And so that left a lot of people vulnerable. And we were getting reports across the state of renters who were being evicted for no reason, particularly low-income seniors who had lived in their homes for 10 years or more and were paying submarket rentals or submarket rents. And basically, I didn't think that we should wait for that to happen en masse in SLO County. The report that I got from some of the legal allies that we have was that tenants in the area, by and large, do not show up to city council asking for help. It's not something that really kind of culturally is supported around here. Tenants don't want to be a bother. There's no options for them here. There's not enough high-paying jobs. So when they get displaced, they tend to just move to the Valley or Idaho or somewhere else. There's no central tenants union or any sort of organizing apparatus for them. And so in Los Angeles and San Francisco and other places, we had reports of 100-unit buildings that were all being evicted at the same time. You know, dozens and dozens and dozens of tenants coming forward at city council asking for renter protections. And so SLO County YIMBY said, this is the fifth or sixth least affordable place in the whole country, so we should really kind of get on this. And we sent emails to the whole county, all of the jurisdictions in the county, the seven cities, and then the Board of Supervisors, and said, hey, we need to really close this loophole and enact an urgency ordinance to protect your renters. And we're very thankful that the city of Morro Bay and San Luis Obispo and Grover Beach all heeded that cry. We did have some tenants come forward and say that it was happening to them. The SLO Legal Assistance Foundation and CRLA both reported an overwhelming number of calls, particularly from seniors who had been living in their homes for a long time, asking for help, saying, I've been living here most of my life, and my rent's been jacked up, and I'm being evicted, and I need help. And they were reporting it happening, so we thought that that was something we needed to address. So that was our most recent victory, and we're very proud of that.
Great. All right. Got it. And yes, I mean, it always surprises me when covering that story that 60% of San Luis Obispo residents are renters. And mm-hmm. it's such a high number. And yet there is no organizing.
There's no options, really. In an ideal world, if your rent got nudged up or if you were being evicted, you would have somewhere else in your neighborhood to go, or you could reasonably find another place that was in your budget. And right now, even if you find something in your budget, there's no guarantee it's going to be in your own community where you have ties and, you know, ways of, you are completely upended when you get evicted or if your rent is raised to a point where you can't afford it. And then for people who do manage to stay in their home, they usually have to find five or six roommates and just overload their space in a way that is uncomfortable for everybody. And that is part of what makes it really hard to get by here as a renter, is just the lack of options. But I do agree that we absolutely need some sort of central tenant organizing apparatus, and hopefully we will be able to help address that.
So let's get into that a little bit of how we got here. What's your perspective?
So the YIMBY perspective on how we got here is a shortage of homes at all income levels. And that's another long story about how we got to a shortage. But basically, we've been underbuilding for our own population growth for decades. The housing affordability crisis really isn't new. It may feel new to some people, but really there's been struggles of affordability at all levels in California since the 70s. And what happened in the 70s was there was kind of a multi-pronged movement against building for lots of reasons. There was the Fair Housing Act that was passed in 1968, and that made it illegal to outright discriminate against people of color and where they could live. And instead of saying people of color can't live here, we're just going to make it so that the only people who can live here are very wealthy. So we started passing a lot of minimum lot sizes, huge tracts of land that were devoted to single family only homes. And that, of course, decreased the supply and made it less accessible to more people at more income levels. And over the decades, we also started a race to the bottom for who could have the most onerous and expensive and time-consuming building process, which makes housing more expensive. If it costs more to build it, then of course it's going to be more expensive to buy it or rent it. And we also have these fun discretionary review processes that are usually held at times that working people cannot attend. You know, I think the Slo County Planning Commission meeting is at 9 o'clock on a Thursday morning, which most people can't get to unless you are retired or can pay for babysitters or can leave your job to attend it. And so these discretionary review processes are basically abused by and large by people who have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo for whatever reason. And sometimes it's for good reasons, and most of the time it's for something that's really kind of self-serving. And developers get a lot of flack for profiting off of building homes, but nobody's talking about how homeowners who have lived there for 10 or 15 years have a financial incentive to keep the housing supply low because it keeps their property values high. And it's this combination of like decades of racism and land use policies that have gotten more and more onerous and burdensome, and allowing people who already have the time and the power and the energy to direct the process at the expense of those who don't have that time, power, and energy, particularly renters, particularly people of color, people with disabilities. And that is part of the reason that we are here today. And what's interesting is we're seeing the same inputs yield the similar outcomes in Seattle, Denver, Austin, Raleigh, North Carolina has a YIMBY group because they're starting to see some of the same issues with sprawl and traffic and unaffordability, places that you wouldn't think of as, oh, that must be expensive to live there. It's becoming more unaffordable across the country.
That was Krista Jeffries, founder of the Slo County YIMBY movement, speaking with KCBX's Greta Mart. YIMBY means Yes in My Backyard and advocates for creating more affordable housing stock in established city neighborhoods. There's more information about Slo County's YIMBY movement on their Facebook page. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Tyler Pratt. KCBX travel correspondent and Issues and Ideas contributor Tom Wilmer is celebrating 30 years with KCBX. Since 1989, Wilmer has been traveling across the world telling stories for KCBX. Already working as a travel ghostwriter in 1989, Wilmer convinced KCBX general manager Frank Lanzone to give him a recorder and do double duty as he traveled California, the U.S., and beyond. Wilmer has since traveled to South Africa, Morocco, Paris, Monte Carlo, China, and many other countries. I recently sat down with Wilmer to talk about his travels and memorable experiences. We kick off the discussion with him telling me how he caught the travel bug in his teens.
In high school, I was an adventurer. I worked every weekend at Sugar Bowl Ski Resort all the way through high school.
And where was this?
In Sierras, okay. Donner Summit. Summer 15, going on 16 years old, I worked all winter painting houses to earn my own airfare on Pan Am to Hawaii. And my dad knew a professor at University of Hawaii, and I lived with him, and I was his lab assistant for a summer. So, you know, 15, I was wanting to travel. That's how I got to Alaska as a crew member on a fishing trawler out of Kodiak, kind of the deadliest catch before they invented the phrase. And because I wanted to travel, I wanted to see Alaska, but how do I get there?
What was that experience like?
Oh my God, it was unbelievable. It's the stuff of book material, and actually I'm working on a book called Shanghai and Other True Tales. And it turned out I got on an Irish boat called the Irish Rover, and the skipper was like this pirate of Alaska, legendary. He was known to beat up seven guys my size in bar fights in Juneau. Nobody messed with him. And he was pretty sadistic, as was the other deckhand. And one night in Kodiak, a kid, when anybody would see my skipper, it was like John Wayne with an Irish accent, and people would come out of the woodwork to listen to him regale them with his stories. And this 19-year-old kid came up and just was enamored with God and wanted to hang out with us. And the skipper seduced him, talked him into buying rounds of drinks for us. In 1975, it was $5 a beer, man. It was $20 a round for four. And by 2 a.m, the skipper had just tricked the guy into spending his airfare home. He was going to leave in the morning, go buy a ticket. And so he couldn't go. And the skipper said, no problem, you got a job with us as a deckhand. So he literally Shanghai'd this kid out of a bar in Kodiak, and I was there watching that, living it. I was a prisoner until we got to Seattle, man. You don't jump ship in the middle of the Aleutians. I mean, it was not a fun experience, but one that I'm glad I did.
Because somehow it continued this travel bug for you, correct?
Yeah, just fascinated. I remember kind of one of the epiphanous transformative moments. I'm sitting on my bed Sunday reading the LA Times travel section, and I go, oh my God, these guys get paid to travel. I want to do that. And so I was writing for New Times, doing local cultural stuff. And I talked them grudgingly into doing my travel stories, but they didn't like it. You know, we're not a travel magazine. And at that time, the travel editor of the Rio Grande paper, the Five Cities Times Press Recorder, which doesn't exist anymore, he got fired. And a friend of mine owned a radio station in town. He said, go down and apply for the job. So I brought my clips from the New Times, and I got hired as travel editor of the Rio Grande paper. So now every Friday, I'm writing the travel section. And so I could do whatever I want. Well, you're not going to go to Istanbul every Friday, but you might go to Santa Barbara or Montecito or Ojai. So I did, and I covered the entire California coast between LA and San Francisco. 4 years later, I realized I'd written a book and didn't even know it. And so I transmuted those weekly posts into a book, and it became a regional bestseller. And it was all coincidence, not because of the book or being great writing. My publisher had just published the first authoritative translation of Khalil Gibran's works. And so the book dealer guy with the distributor, they said, oh yeah, we'll take that, and we'll take this book, Tom's book, whatever it is. And then it got picked randomly as a Father's Day gift selection at every West Coast Walden's and Barnes and Noble. And that's how it, by default, became a bestseller.
What were some of your memorable experiences traveling around the Central Coast?
Oh, my God. So I was thinking about this morning, you know, and it's almost overwhelming. You could just take a dart, you know, and go, oh, hi. I found out about this woman that owns a spa down there. And locals told me that she's the one that is known as the mother of aerobics of the world. She invented aerobics when she was a teacher in Canada in the 60s, and then wound up doing this aerobic program on cruise liners and whatnot, and then it went viral and exploded. And so anyway, so she owns an inn there. She's like 85 or whatever, gets up at 6 a.m., goes for a 3-hour power walk before she works out. It's crazy. I mean, that's a great story right there in Ojai, and probably a lot of people in Ojai don't know the mother of aerobics is there.
So what else?
I'm amazed at the Central Coast, how truly world-class it is. As you know, I've been around the world. I've been so many places. And every time I come back, I go, wow, we are so blessed, so fortunate. Just Morro Bay, where I live, the estuary and the bay and the wildlife, that it's not a zoo is a miracle. I mean, I go for walks there every day when I'm home through the state park, and there'll be hardly anybody there. This world-class destination. Hearst Castle, I've done shows with the historian and the archivist and whatnot, and I'm getting ready to do another with the Hearst Castle Foundation. It's on my hit list. King City. I mean, that's one of these blow-through towns when we're transiting north or south. And you only stop for gas. It's kind of the default. And I kept seeing this sign, this funky billboard for like a trailer park or whatever, in a park, or, and I'm going, what is this place? And one time I had extra time and I poked in. Turns out it's a Monterey County park. And in it, they have recreations of all the ag history of that Salinas Valley, lower Salinas Valley area, tractors, and they towed in the old Southern Pacific train station from King City and restored it. They have barns there. It's just the most amazing county park that so few people know about. Right, you know, quarter, eighth of a mile off the off the Highway 101.
Anything else about the Central Coast that really surprised you, like that King City moment? You know, you didn't get what you expected going in?
The best kept secrets in the greater Central Coast in Monterey County is Hunter Liggett Army Base. It's 26 miles one way off of Highway 101 to get there, and you don't go through there. You got to go to there, and it's the largest Army Reserve training base in the United States of America. And yet, so often, we don't know anything about it. How I discovered it was because of KCBX. We have our KNBX transmitter antenna on the Army base on a hilltop called Williams Hill. And Frank Lanzone, the general manager, asked me to go up and do some maintenance work on the antenna room. So I had to get vetted by the Army and a pass and whatnot to go there. And I thought, well, since I'm on base, I'll go to the headquarters and introduce myself to the public affairs officer, which I did. And I said, hey, let's do a series of shows about the Army Reserve mission here, because nobody knows about it. You know, you guys, frankly, just don't get much press. You do if a helicopter goes down or something awful happens, but that's about it. So we've been doing, in partnership for the last 2-3 years, a series of KCBX shows and shows from my NPR podcast specifically about the Army base and about things that you wouldn't normally think about. For example, military spouses. How often do they get a spotlight or a showcase? You know, rarely ever. So we did a whole show just about the life of the women spouses that live on base. And one of the women we interviewed came from Manhattan. So you can imagine the,
wow.
Yeah, the life shift for her and her kids, and yet wound up loving this remoteness and wildness of that realm of Hunter Liggett out in the Army base. We did a show with the federal firefighters. As you know, firefighters are on duty 24/7, but they truly, for the most part, are unsung heroes. They, you know, they're just kind of out of sight, out of mind until you need them. But these guys are locked and loaded and ready to respond to any eventuality, including a major military aircraft going down or helicopter or tank rollover, you know. So they're also on base. I haven't done this show yet. There's a Mercy Life Flight, a helicopter medical evacuation business, and they're a subcontractor to the Army. The Army does not maintain the medevac helicopter for evac. It's a contracted company, and they have two helicopters full-time on base ready to rock and roll. So that's another unsung hero cool story. Even the story of Hunter Liggett, that the base is named after, I didn't know. A lot of people in the Army don't know who, you know, what a lot of people think is hyphenated. It turns out that he was a general in World War I and was like the second most legendary Army general in the war. And he's the one that transformed military Army tactics that are still used to this day. And one day, in honor of the conclusion of World War I, they had a military historian from Washington, D.C. come out and do a presentation at Hunter Liggett, and they invited me to cover that. So I did a whole show with him about who was Hunter Liggett. So that's auguring pretty deep in the remote bowels of the Central Coast, you know, off the beaten track.
That was KCBX's Tom Wilmer sharing memories from his 30 years as a travel correspondent for KCBX. We're going to take a short break. When we return, Wilmer talks about a trip down under to go on a cattle drive and what it was like to realize how vast the Australian outback really is.
It might be a 5-hour drive to your nearest neighbor. That's how huge that world is out there.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Before the break, I was speaking with KCBX's Tom Wilmer about memories from his 30 years as a travel correspondent for KCBX. We discussed some of his favorite Central Coast sites. Now we turn to a few of his favorite memories traveling abroad.
This is a story of the power of Instagram. So I spent time in Chengdu, Sichuan province, as in Sichuan food. The hot and spicy. So the head of tourism of this town of 16 million, he's a 30-year-old guy, really cool. We became buddies and established kind of a little friendship, you know, emailing and stuff. So he started following me on Instagram, and I'd post these pictures of me kayaking on Morro Bay, and they were sunset shots, you know, with the otters in the background and whales broaching out front. And he goes, oh my God, you're right. Your town is so beautiful. You know, he goes, I must come see. And so I do another one. And he goes, no, I'm definitely coming. So he did. He came from China to come to Morro Bay and go kayaking with me. It was so cool.
That's super cool.
I know. But again, isn't that interesting? Instagram. I mean, I don't have that many followers, but there's some power there.
One thing that jumped out at me from your very long resume of work that you've done is that you went on a 6-day cattle drive in Australia, and this won a pretty big award.
Wow.
I'm interested in knowing how you take something about a 6-day experience traveling across the outback and then take all of that information and compile it into something that is short.
15 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, let's take, it actually was 2 weeks on my first trip down there.
Oh, wow.
And I was so busy. You're sitting in the saddle in the outback riding, herding cattle. You're not going to be taking notes. You know, it's just not going to happen. And it was one of those so consuming experiences that I got home and I had like a half a page of notes.
Oh, wow.
I know. And I went to the Australian government. I go, could you send me back again to just do surgical interviews with those that I was riding with?
And they did?
They did. They said, if we're not going to do your airfare, but if you can get there, we'll take care of you. And they set everything up, and they did. And these were some legendary outback folk that I was with. They have a big billboard in Australia, South Australia, and it says the 7 legends of the outback. And they have these 7 guys horseback. And I looked up at the billboard and I go, oh my God, I know all 7 of them and I'm friends with them. So when I went back, I spent time with them. And briefly, the world of the outback is so huge. It's mind blowing. I still don't have a way to put it in my mind. A small cattle ranch is 650,000 acres, where the guy might be embarrassed to tell you how small his place is. It takes so much land to maintain the cattle that the average is one head per square mile. So I was on 1 million acre cattle stations. I was on the largest in Australia, like 1.2 million. It might be a 5-hour drive to your nearest neighbor. That's how huge that world is out there. Back in the day, before they put a railroad in called the GAN that goes north to south across Australia, all transport of heavy stuff was by camels. They had camel trains, and they had Afghani camel herders that ran them. And that's why the GAN Railway is called that today, in honor of the Afghans. And so talking to the old timers about receiving supplies, and this one guy said, yeah, we had a piano delivered and they strapped it to the side of this camel and bringing it out.
Oh my gosh.
So when they were done with the camel trains, rather than kill them, they just let them loose. And the camels have become a huge environmental issue in the Australian outback today. I forget the numbers, but I'm sure it's way over 100,000. They have camel hunts where people go out, hunters, to get camel for the camel meat and whatnot, and herd thinning. Who would think or know that Australia has this mega wild camel herd?
Well, it looks like returning back to Australia for this piece paid off, because you won a $10,000 prize for that?
There's the most famous outback poet in Australia is a guy named Henry Lawson. So Australian tourism has an annual award called the Henry Lawson Travel Writing Award. So I did a 13-page feature with about 16 of my photos in a big slick magazine out of Dallas called Cowboys and Indians. So the publisher submitted it. They have to submit, you know, for this contest and write a letter why it's deserving. And it won the award for all North America. And what was really cool, the prize was a trip for two weeks down under. And I'd been to Australia 5 times, and Beth, my wife, had never been there. And I thought she'd probably kill me if I went again by myself. So she got to come with me this time. And I deferred. I really wanted to go to Northern Territories and way out to Perth on the West Coast. And for her, I said, well, we'll do the Great Barrier Reef and Sydney and whatnot. So I redid things so that she could see them. But that was really cool.
Now, you edit and work with a bunch of other publications as well, right?
Yeah.
Where else can we see your work?
Well, I think if you Googled 360 Magazine plus Tom Wilmer, I'm their culture editor. And when I have time, I do a travel piece for them. Every issue in New York City, there's a super high-end, new, slick, millennial and XY Gen magazine. And don't ask me why. Well, I do know why. The editor was an editor at 360 Magazine in LA, and she got picked to be editor in New York. She asked me and invited me to be their travel editor. And I'm going, yeah. I mean, it's so cool. You saw the magazine. It's super slick. And so I do, in each issue, their travel feature. And pretty much I can decide, you know, we'll powwow and I go, okay, you know, I'd like to do Belize or whatever. And so far they've been amenable to whatever I've suggested.
Does it ever feel like work, all of this glamorous travel around the globe, but
no.
You have to turn around a product at the end of it and sit down?
No, and I
and
think
work on something?
Part of it, I've been doing radio for 30 years. I've done my own editing for 12 years, and I love it. I'm really good at Pro Tools. I can go in my little studio at 11 p.m. and do audio editing, and in my sleep, you know, clean it up. And it's kind of like, hey, do you want to come over and play a really fun game? You know, something really engaging. That's what editing is for me. I love people. I'm fascinated by everybody and what they do that it's like going to a candy store. As you know, I just did a whole series about Ann Arbor and the University of Michigan. And one day I met the anthropology department with the head, and then archaeology and natural history. And what a candy store, if you're curious, you know. I mean, just what a blessing.
What are you curious to do in the years to come, in your next 30 years of doing radio?
I think just more of the same. You know, we've talked about some of it. I'd love to do a series about Vandenberg locally. It's right in our own backyard. I think we even have a translator just for the Vandenberg area. And yet we rarely do stuff about Vandenberg unless it's some big issue, missile launch or whatever. But it's the same thing. It'd be cool to kind of auger in, you know, what's daily life on the base? You know, what do the civilian support staff do? And, you know, what's their mission? Just, you know, those sort of things would be really cool to do.
Well, Tom Wilmer, host of Journeys of Discovery, which you can hear here on Issues and Ideas and on KCBX. You can also search for that under NPR, under their podcasts.
If you do, you have to search Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer. Because if you go Journeys of Discovery, it's some women's environmental group. So okay. you'll never get to me.
Well, Tom, it's been really wonderful having you part of the KCBX family for this long. And congratulations on 30 years of radio reporting.
Crazy, huh?
You're tuned to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. The Salinas, California newspaper recently published a deeply reported story about how low wages and a stagnant housing market have pushed Salinas farmworking families to the margins. The report is titled, Staying Close, Salinas Farmworkers Make a Home Amid California's Housing Crisis. Photographed by Sebastian Hidalgo, the story was reported by Kate Simony. KCBX's Greta Mart spoke with Simony about the story to learn more.
So tell me how this story came about and what prompted you to start reporting on this story.
This story had actually been in the works for quite a while. We wanted to take a really good long look at farmworker housing. Farmworker housing as in housing dedicated just to farmworkers, potentially by ag companies, and, you know, just housing that farmworkers go out and find on their own. And we were trying to figure out an angle that would take a look at that and not just tell the same story over again in the exact same way.
And the farm workers that you spoke, what would they prefer? Would they prefer to just find housing on the open market, or would they prefer to have dedicated farm worker housing?
So we spoke with a lot of H2A workers for this article, and ultimately ended up not incorporating as much as we could about them because just our sourcing wasn't as strong as we wanted there, because people were concerned about maintaining their statuses. From H2A workers, what I heard was they really wanted farm worker housing. I don't think they were excited about continuing to live in dorm style, but they didn't want to live in motels. They found that the motels were pretty restrictive. For example, they couldn't cook for themselves a lot of the time. Maybe there would be a hot plate, maybe there'd be a microwave, but there was no guarantee. There was really no privacy. There wasn't really a place to hang out. They had to hang out in their rooms. They found that difficult. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but in Salinas, H2A workers are often housed in motels. It's a way for the motels to continuously turn a profit, and the growers to have a place to house their H2A workers. When I spoke with farm workers who live in Salinas, you know, they weren't looking for farm worker housing per se. They wanted the independence of living on their own and finding something that best suited their needs as opposed to the needs that were determined for them. You know, they wanted to be close to certain schools, maybe schools that their kids were already in or that they thought were serving their population well. So I think that there's, you know, even within just the farmworking community, there's quite a lot of diversity of interests, of needs, and of, you know, just people.
How did you find these people that are in your story? How did you reach out to them? What kind of engagement did you have in that community?
That was something we worked really hard on. We reached out to a bunch of people we already had contacts with, people who worked in housing, you know, politicians, that kind of thing. And we ended up getting directed to the LaSalle Family Resource Center, where their director, Dr. Carissa Purnell, is just doing a fabulous job working with the community and making sure that people are getting access to resources.
The start of the article, you say Salinas is one of the most expensive places to live in the U.S.?
Yeah, according to the 2016 housing study out of Harvard before they moved to just naming zones and were still naming cities. Salinas was listed as, I believe, the fifth most expensive place to live in the U.S. comparatively. And by comparatively, we mean average salary compared to rent, cost of living, et cetera. And people here, we have a very large farm worker population who, I believe on average, according to studies by the federal government, make an average of about $17,500 a year as farm workers. Some people do make more, people do make less. And when you compare that to rent on a one-bedroom home, often being $1,600, $1,700 a month, and that's just from my personal experience looking for places to rent, that can get pretty tricky. It can get very, very difficult for people, especially if they're supporting a whole family.
What were your biggest takeaways from the reporting you've done so far? What would you really like people to get out of this reporting?
What we wanted to do was we wanted to give people a much more intimate sense of what the housing crisis looks for some average people. We featured in our article a couple of women, one who works as a garlic peeler at Christopher Ranch in Gilroy, Jenny. I met her because she was experiencing an eviction, which housing advocates suggested was related to AB 1482, which recently passed in California, the Tenant Protection Act of 2019. And she opened her home to us. She let us come for hours, spend time with herself and her grandson, just learn about what her life was like. And she's somebody who chooses every day to find the positive. She's got a lot going on. She says she's very stressed out at the moment in particular because she is still trying to find a new place to live. But this housing crisis, I mean, it's happening to her. And it's something that she's dealing with on a daily basis, and it just gets folded into your life. And it's very, very similar for Resi. Resi Salvador is a young woman that we also interviewed for this story. Spent a lot of time with Resi. She grew up moving up and down the coast of California following her father's work as a farm worker. She didn't have a bed until she was 14. Her parents bought her a mattress that year. They bought her a used mattress at the flea market. She spent most of her, you know, she's 19 now, she spent most of her life sleeping on a cobija, a blanket, just with another one pulled over her. And for her, that is absolutely normal. And it was really eye-opening to see that, you know, people can fold in different experiences into their lives. And, you know, they make them a part of their life story, of their tapestry. And while the housing crisis may be affecting them, they have a lot of other things going on too. They're still, you know, attending classes or going to work or, you know, trying to get their car registration to go through. Everything here touches everything else. It is a multifaceted issue. And I think actually Dr. Carissa Purnell said it best. She said something like housing and immigration, nothing's in a silo and they all touch one another and they all impact one another. And that I think was probably my biggest takeaway from this story was that there was no way to separate these issues from one another. And we had to really wrestle with this story to make sure that that was reflecting that. Because so many people in Salinas are indeed living this housing crisis, but they're also living a lot of other things, and there's no way to say that only one is impacting them or one is having a certain impact because they're all woven together.
That was Kate Simone, reporter for the Salinas, California newspaper, and Cal Matters, a nonprofit, nonpartisan media venture. You can find a link to Simone's reporting by clicking on this story at kcbx.org. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. The Central Coast has a new option for getting fit. It's called aerial arts, also known as flying trapeze. This type of workout is newly available in Santa Barbara through the Santa Barbara Trapeze Company. You may have seen advertisements while driving through town. The school is located in the Earl Warren Showground, visible from the 101 freeway. Contributor Beth Thornton recently spoke with instructor Shane Weave.
This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas. I'm talking with Shane Weaver, who runs the Santa Barbara Trapeze Company with partners Randy Cohn and F.A. Ilke. Welcome, Shane. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks a lot, Beth. It's great to be here.
So a trapeze workout is definitely a new fitness idea for the general public. Tell us how the idea came about and why you chose Santa Barbara.
Flying trapeze is a fantastic old a complete body workout. I've been teaching trapeze for about 17 years now recreationally. I guess trapeze originally became more so available to the public through Club Med. You could come down and go and fly when you're on vacation. And then after that, it become more so in larger cities and become really popular that it's something I can go and do that is kind of cool and fun and exciting and also a great workout.
You're on the Earl Warren Showgrounds property in the parking lot there. So it's outside. People can see you flipping and flying as they're driving by.
Yes, yes. We're right the highway at Earl Warren, right by the 101. And every time I mention trapeze to anybody, everyone says, I've seen you guys flying as I drive by. So
give us a little of your personal history with trapeze. Mm-hmm. How were you introduced to it and how has it been a part of your life?
So I was introduced to flying trapeze and the circus arts through French Woods Festival at the summer camp in upstate New York. I went there when I was 18 as a water ski instructor. And once I got there, they needed an extra guy for the trapeze and I'm strong. And so they said, okay, come on down. And from then I fell in love with it. I was 18 then and I went back when I was 19 and 20 as a counselor every year and learned more and more circus. And then when I went back to Australia for a few years, I trained some more with a trainer in Australia. And since then I've managed flying trapeze rigs in Cincinnati and also in Long Island in New York and now in Santa Barbara.
Have you ever been a part of a circus?
I've never traveled to the circus and performed as a performer. Randy has traveled as a performer, one of our partners, and I've performed plenty with our schools. If we put on a show, sometimes we'll put on an exhibition, which is a wonderful opportunity. We have some of our students fly. They get to kind of show their skills and their friends and family can come out and watch a little low-key flying trapeze show. And then afterwards, we usually fly as well, so they get to see the guys who are throwing a little bigger tricks and a little crazier. And
is trapeze like a combination of acrobatics and trampoline? Or what are the similar sports?
Yes, gymnasts do really well, and it's actually very similar to diving. And also to trampoline. So trampoline skills play very well. It's that twisting and turning through the air. We have some pole vaulters now. One of our new guys is a pole vaulter, and that force out, that push to go up and over suits really well with trapeze. So
basically being fearless with a strong upper body?
Fearless is not actually necessary. It is helpful, but it's interesting when people come, even if they're very, really, really afraid of heights and they get up and just swing and they're like, I'm doing trapeze and this is enough for me, that is great. We want to encourage that. And if someone wants to come and they're a gymnast and want to do crazy backflips and whatever, we want to encourage that too. So fearless or not fearless is not a problem. You don't even really have to have a lot of upper body strength. You're not doing pull-ups or you're not really moving or pulling up when you're on the trapeze. You're just hanging and swinging. So as long as you can hang by your hands from a pull-up bar for 10 or 15 seconds, you would easily be able to do the trapeze. A 75-year-old lady flew the other day, and she did great and had an awesome time.
Do you have people coming out to train with you who are maybe interested in things like Cirque du Soleil?
One of our staff, LJ, has flown with Cirque before, so we have some really high-end instructors. Usually if that happens, it's only kind of one-off or is not as common, but sometimes flyers will come out. We've had professional flyers come out and fly with us for a week, and they're usually friends of ours, and we know them, so they're coming and kind of training with staff.
You opened in September, just a few months ago.
Yep.
I've noticed that there are people out there, and you're giving a lot of lessons.
Yeah.
So walk us through lesson number one.
Mm-hmm. So when somebody comes for a first class, most of the people that fly with us are beginners, have never done it before. As they come, obviously, you sign your waiver, you get to check out the trapeze, get a little excited, get a little nervous. Once we get the class started, we'll give you an introduction. We'll give you the lowdown on what to expect. This is what's going to happen. You're going to climb the ladder. The safety line's here. So you're fully aware of what you're about to step into. We put on your safety harness, and one at a time, you climb up the ladder. When you get up the top of the ladder, the instructor clips you in, gets you ready to take off, and when you're ready, you take the leap. We usually just have you swing, enjoy the trapeze. You get the feeling of that, the takeoff. It's a pretty overwhelming, even just doing that. So we usually try and work at everybody's pace so they're comfortable. And then when they're ready, We teach you to hook your knees on the bar like you would on the monkey bars when you're a kid, and hang upside down by your hands and arch back. We're doing that with the goal, if you're ready by the end of class, to swing across. We put another instructor up on the other trapeze, and they hang upside down by their legs, usually me or one of the other guys. We do a mid-air transfer. You straighten your legs, and we swing down. You swing together with me, and then we swing back up, and you sit in the net, just let go, and then you're done. That's like the grand finale toward the end of class. Not everybody does it. Sometimes people just swing, and sometimes people take two or three classes to learn to do the knee hang, and that's totally okay. It's flying trapeze. It's awesome and challenging.
What's the ultimate flying trapeze move? At what point can you go out and boast about being a flying trapeze artist?
Probably as soon as you've done your first class. A lot of people are boasting, and I encourage that. We're like, yeah, you did a knee hang in a backflip. Tell everybody. Obviously, you have your photos and your videos, so people are usually boasting pretty quick, but usually once you step into like a layout or a double back tuck is like the first bigger trick that you'll see. If you go to see a circus show, that's usually like what they're starting with, is this double back tuck, or and then it goes to like a double layout. So they're laying the backflips out, which is crazy, and they even do a double-double, which is a double layout. And while they're doing the double layout backflip, they're doing two twists as well. So they... It's incredible to watch. To watch it, it looks like they're just flipping through the
air.
And
this comes after years of practice.
Years and years and years of practice.
Tell us about the rig.
Mm-hmm. It's actually quite a simple design. It's four A-frames that kind of go up and across and over. They're made of aluminum, aircraft-grade aluminum. Everything's rated to about 10 times the amount of what we need. We could probably hang a car from the rig. One is the pedestal board where you climb up and stand on. The next A-frame is where the trapeze hangs from and you swing backwards and forwards from that one. The third one is where the catcher swings from, where I would swing from if we do the transfer. And the fourth one is where the net comes along and goes up at the end. So if I caught you and somehow we let go and the safety line didn't, you would land in the net and roll down. So when we're not set up, you don't see the net, but when we're running classes and you see people flipping, you'll see the net.
And how high is the platform?
And so the top of the rig is about 33 feet, and the platform probably stands around 23 or 24.
Do you ever have people freeze up on the platform, and you kind of have to coax them into grabbing the bar? And
Obviously, what we're doing is bringing people right up to the edge of their comfort zone. We specialize in looking after our students in that way. They're very nervous to reach out, and they're very nervous to take the plunge off the platform. But once they're swinging, they're like, this is great, and that was so much fun, and I was so worried about that moment. And now that it's over, it was great. So, and that's the thing, you get there and you go, wow, this is pretty crazy, but these guys are organized, it's buttoned up, our space is beautiful. We take pride in how we're presenting ourselves, the flying trapeze, as a sport and as our company. The fun of trapeze is wonderful, but to leave and think, wow, I'm like tougher than I thought, or maybe it puts a little crack in that glass ceiling of like, what am I capable of?
Imagine that the weather does play a small role. I mean, Santa Barbara obviously has fairly mild weather, but you don't fly in the rain.
What about heavy winds?
So
usually if it's like super heavy winds, or if it's raining like before class, we won't. Sometimes if we're in class and it would be a light drizzle, it's not bad because we're not, like everything, the bar stays dry, everything you pretty much are swinging on, we keep dry. If at any point in time it's like, listen, it's not safe, we'll cut it off. Safety is obviously our number one concern. And
tell people who are interested in this how they can get a hold of you and what they should plan to wear and all of that kind of thing.
The website is called Fly Trapeze Santa Barbara. It's just athletic wear, tight fitting. You don't want to wear loose jewelry, but pretty much anybody can fly, ages 4 and up. You don't wear shoes, but you can bring your socks along. And we have a lot of information on our frequently asked questions page on our website as well.
Shane, thank you so much for talking with me today. Shane Weaver from Santa Barbara Trapeze Company.
Thanks.
I'm Beth Wharton.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.